I returned to Birkenhead, and when I got to the dry dock, there was the ship. She'd all been, had the engines overhauled and everything, and was repainted. She looked really smart. When we first came into dry dock, she was painted in the all grey, which all ships were during the war years. They were all painted grey, but now she was painted in the company's colours, which was a black hull and white upper structure, and a creamy buff funnel with a red shell on each side of the funnel. She looked real smart, looked different ship altogether. So I got aboard and reported to the chief steward. A couple of days, the stores started arriving and had to be put aboard. And at that time, the 40s and the 50s, you had to order as much stores as possible in sterling areas, and because the dollars were so dear. So most ships in the British Navy, the Merchant Navy, they had to buy their stores in the sterling areas, and only in emergencies order in dollar areas. That's like the States and their subsidiaries. So we had to stock up pretty well with stores. The new stewards arrived. In the catering department, there was a chief steward, second steward, three assistant stewards, chief cook, second cook and baker, and a galley boy, and an officer's, petty officer's mess boy. That was the catering department. So Julie Beale got all loaded up, and when we, just before we left, rather, there was a VIP came on board. He was one of the directors of Shell, apparently, and also he was working, or he had been working for the Ministry of Food during the war. He was a Lord, I just can't remember his name, whether it was Lord MacDonald or something like that. But he was the head of MacDougall's Flour Corporation. And he was going to the States on Ministry of Food business. But he'd had a busy time previously, and he apparently had decided that he would like to go on a leisurely trip across the Atlantic. So he'd arranged with Shell Mex for him to be given a passage on board the Natasina. He was the only passenger. We had no passenger accommodation. But on a lot of their ships, they had a room just on the main deck, which was a hospital. Had a couple of bunks in it, and adjoining it there was a bath, the only bath in the cruise accommodations. It was all showers, but just off the hospital there was a bath and a toilet. So he was given the hospital to spend the voyage in. He was an extremely nice gentleman, and chief steward told me that I had to look after him. Normally my job as second steward was to look after the captain and be in charge of the pantry during meals and help the chief steward with the issuing of stores and bonded stores. The bonded stores, of course, we used to carry drinks, beers, and spirits for the officers. The officers were allowed spirits, and the crew were allowed beers. That was all that we used to carry there. But we, on tankers, ordinary matches and cigarette lighters weren't allowed on board. So each man was given an issue of special safety matches. And we used to get an issue of soap. And these were all kept in the chief steward's store, on just underneath the main deck. So that was my job, helping the chief steward there. Hey, this old lord, he didn't like the mattress so well, so I went into the storeroom and I got him an extra mattress and put that on top, so he had two mattresses, which he was most grateful. So we set off and we left Birkenhead and set off across the Atlantic for Aruba, which was nearly a 10 days trip, maybe a bit less, I just can't remember now, a week to 10 days. So anyway, we had a quite pleasant trip across to Aruba, and there the old lord, he left the ship and flew from there to Washington, and he gave me a £25 tip, which in those days was an extremely large amount of money, for which I was most grateful. But it was very funny. Midday every day, just before lunch, the captain and some of his officers, they used to have a midday drink, a gin and it or something. Usually a gin and then whiskies in the evening. So the captain, he invited this Lord, I don't know, it was McGregor or what it was now. He invited him up to his cabin every lunchtime for a drink. Our Jimmy Gill, he was really a rough common sort of a chap. He never got invited up to the cabin's, captain's cabin for a gin. And from the officer's accommodation, there was a flight of stairs went up to the next deck where the captain's cabin and the radio room was. So Jimmy Gill used to stand at the bottom of these stairs, and he used to, after this man had gone up to the captain's cabin for his midday drinks, Jimmy Gill used to stand at the bottom of the stairs, and he said, "It's all right for some, Lord Bloody Plush. No drinks for the workers." I first time I heard him say it, I thought, you know, it'd be terrible row, but as I said, the captain was very, very nervous type of chap, and Jimmy used to bully him quite a bit. Hey, this old chap, he took it all right, and after a couple of days, he come along to our accommodation, and up to Jimmy Gill's cabin, and said, "Can Lord Plush have a drink with you today?" So he didn't take it badly, but that was the sort of chap Jimmy Gill was. So we got to Aruba and they were still playing rum and Coca-Cola. They must have kept that song up, I don't know how many years, but it was all over the town, rum and Coca-Cola. And we loaded there and then we came back to the UK to Jarrow on Tyneside with the cargo. When we'd unloaded there, we set off to Bayonne, New Jersey, where we loaded another cargo. And from there we went to Thames Haven. Now then, I'd kept in touch with one or two of my old shipmates. I still kept in touch with Philip Brideson from Douglas here, and Les Prattley, who'd been on the Empire Alliance and the Empire McMahon with me. I kept in touch with him. I'd lost touch with all the other old shipmates. And he'd met a girl. He'd left the sea. And he was living in London. And apparently he'd got a job delivering coal. And he'd met a girl, and they got engaged, and he told him, wrote and told me they were going to get married, and he wanted me to be his best man. So he kept asking me, keep in touch and let me know when your ship's. When the ship's in port, you know. So I'd heard that we were going from Jarrow, we were going back to Bayonne, New Jersey, and then we were coming back to Thameshaven, which is near London. That's just up the Thames. So I got on the telephone while we were in Jarrow and told them, you know, that we'd be back near this date. And he said, right, I'll arrange the wedding, you know, so let me know as soon as the ship docks. So we went to Bayonne, New Jersey, and then we came back to Thameshaven. So I phoned Prattley up as soon as the ship was in dock, and he came down to see me. And we were going to be there 3 or 4 days, and he'd had the wedding arranged. I think it was on the Saturday while we were there. So that was all done. He gave me the time of the wedding and the church. At Harrow on the Hill, this girl, Pam, she lived in Harrow. So he gave me the name of the church and that, and told me the time, and said, get there early if you can, he said, and I'll give you the ring when you get there. So it was all arranged, and then come this Saturday morning, I got all smarting up and in number one uniform on and all. I'd been to the barber's the day before and had a haircut. And to get to Harrow, I had to go from Thameshaven into the city to, I'm not sure, it was Fenchurch Street Station, or Baker Street Station, and then get on the underground out to Harrow. So anyway, I got the train, got to Baker Street, and come out. And I was just going along looking for the underground station when I met a chap who'd been on the Empire Alliance with us, Phil Lester, the second cook. So he says, blimey, he said he'd left the Merchant Navy. He said, are you still at sea? He said, I thought you would have packed the sea up when the war finished. I said, no, no. So he said, well, let's go and have a drink. I said, oh, no, I'm going to a wedding. I can't. He said, oh, surely you've got time for one. So he dragged me into this pub and we had a couple of drinks. And he was quite an enterprising lad. He told me that when he left the Merchant Navy, he couldn't get a job that he fancied. So washing machines were just coming on the market then, and there was one made by the Rolls Razor people called the Rolls washing machine, and he'd bought one of these. And then he'd advertised in the papers to collect and wash dirty nappies, babies' nappies, to collect and wash. So he had bought a little second-hand van, and he was going around collecting nappies and washing them, ironing them, and delivering them again. He started off doing that, and he made quite a bit of money. Then he stopped that and went into office cleaning. And at that time, he told me he had about a dozen blokes working for him, cleaning offices. So he was telling me this, and just one more. And I told him, listen, I'm going to Prattley's wedding. And he said, oh, I remember Prattley, yeah, you know, and all this, that. And give him my regards and best wishes. And they finished, I'd lost time. I said, I've got to be going, Phil. So I dashed off, got an underground train out to Harrow on the Hill, and I arrived at the church just as the bride and groom were coming out. I've never felt so small in my life, honestly. I didn't know what to say or do. However, when Bradley saw me, I could see his face was blazing. But anyway, I apologised and made the best excuses I could, you know. After them waiting to get married till I got home, it was an awful thing to do. But such is life, I suppose. Anyway, they forgave me, and I still correspond with them. Every Christmas we send each other a card and a letter letting us know how each other's getting on. But he's been a good friend over the years. And as I said, I was still in touch with Philip Bryson. But he'd left the Going Sailing Deep Sea, and he'd got a job on the Isle of Man steamers. So he wasn't going deep sea anymore. Anyway, I'd taken up photography. I bought a camera and I'd taken up developing and printing my own photographs at sea as a hobby. Used to pass the night time away, the spare time away, so enjoyed doing it. I was getting quite good at it too. So from Shellhaven, we went on to Beaumont and Fort Arthur in Texas. I rather liked the places we went to in Texas. I got up to Galveston and right then it was quite nice country, and I thought the people were very nice too. And we loaded up there and we set off sail, crossed back over the Atlantic, and we went up the Manchester Ship Canal up to Ellesmere Port with the cargo. So once I got me business, got my time to go ashore, my turn of shore leave, I went to visit my cousins, the Pendleberries, in Port Sunlight, the ones I went to earlier in the war when I went to Southport to see Joyce Hughes. So though it was nice to see them again, they were quite surprised when I turned up, and chatting and talking, and the time went on, and then I wasn't too sure about buses, and the youngest of the family, Betty, she told me I had to get the bus down to the pierhead at Birkenhead, and then I'd get a bus direct out to Ellesmere Port. So she told me the time she thought the last bus, so I set off. And when I got down to Birkenhead, the pierhead at Birkenhead, the last bus had gone. And there still wasn't many buses or cars at that time, because petrol was still rationed and everything was short. So I had to set up and I had to walk all the way back to Ellesmere Port. I kept looking to see if a car had come and I could hitch a ride. Well, one or two passed, but none of them stopped. I can't say how many miles it is from the Birkenhead, the pierhead there, to Ellesmere Port, but it's a hell of a lot of miles. I arrived back at the ship about 6 o'clock in the morning, absolutely done in, just in time to start work. I'll never forget that. My legs have never been the same since. And we sailed from there to Curacao, and while we were in Curacao, the ship's chandler came aboard, and he was trying to tell us. They all tried, the ship's chandlers tried to push stuff onto the chief stewards, and this chandler got onto Harry Osborne about a load of cheap soft drinks, orangeade, limeade, lemonade, cola and all those sort of things. And just after the war, there were stuff was bottled in. To be honest, I don't know what it was. But these bottles, I don't think they were proper glass, because it had printed them on them, not to be reused. I don't think it was proper glass. It must have been some wartime substitute. Anyway, they were a ridiculous low price. So Harry Osborne, he loaded up with these. I said to him, well, you know, you've ordered far too many. He says, oh, they'll keep these. They'll keep dirt cheap, these. They'll last us. So we filled the storeroom practically with these soft drinks. So we set off and went back across the Atlantic and went into the Mediterranean, and we went to Vado and Savona in Italy, and then through the Suez Canal. Now, when we got into the hot weather, these bottles of pop, what was in them, God only knows. But it was about four nights a week the steward opened the bonded store. I think it was every night from 6 o'clock to about 7:30 to sell stuff to the crew. They wanted their beers or these soft drinks. But these soft drinks, they started off exploding. We'd pick one up and go to hand it to them, to one of the lads who'd ordered it, and things would explode in the hand. They were quite dangerous. Now then, it got that bad as we got down into the Persian Gulf. We couldn't get into the storeroom. We had to get sacks and put them over our heads and go in our hands and knees to get in. Now, Harry Osborne, one hit him on the head. I shouldn't laugh, I know. But they turned him absolutely queer. He was shaking like a leaf from head to foot. And he was incoherent. You couldn't understand what he was saying. I had to get him, put him in his bunk, and bring the captain down. So it was that bad that by the time we got to Abadan, he had to go ashore to a mental hospital. I felt awful sorry for him, because he was an awful, to me he was an awful nice chap. To the crew, they didn't like him because he wouldn't give them the extra bits of sugar or tea. Called the Wizard of Oz, as I've already mentioned. So poor Harry was put ashore to be sent home. So the captain sent for me. I went up. He says, well, you're chief steward now, Adams. I'm promoting you chief steward as from today. So there I was. I was promoted chief steward. This was all through getting caught with me watch from the previous voyage. So I took over as chief steward. Now he told me to get as much stores as I could as possible in Abadan, because we were going to go on a long voyage. So he didn't tell me where at the time, but it was going to be a long trip, he said, so get as much load as you can. So I took over and I ordered stuff. And we set off, and it turned out we left Abadan en route for Shanghai in China. It was an awful long trip. If you look at the map from Abadan, right down the Persian Gulf, through the Indian Ocean, up into the China Seas, it's a long trip. So I took a bit of time settling in as chief steward. I grew to really like the job. You had to oversee all the catering staff. See the cook. First of all, you made the menus up. You prepared the menus in league with the chief cook. And you had to oversee the loading of stores, especially the refrigerated stores, that's in the meats and vegetables. And you had to supervise and pack that refrigerator with meat so that you knew what every bit was, so that you weren't, say, having beef for a week and then pork for a week. You had to have it all spaced out and set out so that you had a variety of meals over the journey. Same with vegetables. You're in charge of sending the laundry ashore and getting it done, and making sure it was back on board, washed, ironed, and stored away ready for the next voyage, and cleaning materials, everything needed for catering on a ship. And the issue, as I've already mentioned, the issuing stores to the crew. Now, this crew that had been coming back to Ozzie, Harry Osmond, so I thought, blimey, they're going to be coming back to me, so what do I do? So I took an engineer, and the second officer used to come and have a drink in my cabin, so I got at the second engineer, and he says, "You still got some lead in the engine room." He says, "What I'll do," he says, "I'll give me the scoops and I'll sweat a bit of lead underneath the scoop and spread it out so that you can't see." He said, "Then," I realised what he was getting on towards. He said, "You're giving them a little bit less on the stores day, but when they come back in the middle of the week, you give them a bit more, so you're only making up what they were entitled to in the first place." So that's what we done. He was a Geordie from Sunderland. So he sweated this bit of lead underneath, and when the crew were coming round for the stores, I used to put them in and let the scale go down with a bit of a bang and give it them. Then in the middle of the week, sure enough, there'd be a long orchid, let us have a spoonful of tea or a cupful of sugar, steward. So I used to say, "Aye, okay now, but don't come it too often. You know, you've had your ration, don't come it too often." And they said, "Oh, God bless you, son, God bless you." Bit of kidology, but I think life's a lot of kidology. Anyway, we arrived in Shanghai, and it was just at that time when the Civil War was on, and the communists were just on the outskirts of Shanghai. There was a lot of fighting going on there. We had to lie at anchor. Oh, for, I forget, it was about a week before we could get in, because everything was slowed up in the docks because of the Civil War. And as I said, the communists were just on the outskirts. Everyone, a lot of the Chinese people want to get away to Hong Kong. And it was an amazing city. I only got ashore a couple of times, but we were lying at anchor. That's a funny thing. Lying at anchor, and like a sampan come alongside with a load of women on. And these women came on board. They were wonderful women, they were. They called them so-so girls, or so-so women. They come on and they say, "I marry you for a week." So there was no sex involved. They used to come on board and they'd wash all your clothes, scrub the, wash the walls in the cabin, and clean the carpets, the passageways, the toilets and the showers, cleaning the galley, and any of your uniforms, any bit of alterations or rips or tears, they sewed them up. That's where they got the name sew-sew women. They used to come out about 9 o'clock in the morning with this stamp pan, and then about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the sampan came out, and the chap on it, he used to ring a bell. Then these old women all got their sewing bags and that, and went over the side onto the sampan and come back next day. They really smartened the ship up. Everybody had a, well, working one woman between two in the crew. They were really remarkable, very, very clean people. So these were, the chap was in charge of them. I used to give them a bit of stores to take ashore. And this chap who brought them out in the sampan, I was talking to him, and he was saying he was wanting to get away to Hong Kong before the communists come. It was terrible. And then we came alongside, and there were some little kids came aboard. There were two or three of them. Only about between 8 years old and 10. Asking for bucksheesh, you know, have you any cigarettes so we can sell them? And it was funny that they were asking for pussycat cigarettes. And we couldn't understand what pussycat cigarettes were. But at that time in England, there were cigarettes for sale called Craven A. And on the packets, there was just a little round part of the design, a cat's face. And these were what they called pussycat cigarettes. They could get more money for them. Now then, there was one little lad, he hung around the pantry, helping in the pantry, washing dishes at the officers. That's the officers' pantry. And we all got quite attached to him, nice little kid. Very willing, all a big smile on his face. Now the cook we had, he was a Welshman. I've never had much time for Welshmen. But he was a thin, wheezy sort of a bloke. And he used to keep muttering to himself, talking in Welsh. And when he got in conversation, he was always, "Wales for the Welsh." He wasn't very popular at all with anybody on board. Now then, the second steward sent this little lad along to the galley to pick something up to bring amidships. The galley on the ship, there was only one galley for the officers and the crew, and that was right down at the stern of the ship. And the officers' accommodation and dining saloon was in the middle of the ship, in the centre castle, as it was called. So the second steward sent this little lad along to the galley to pick something up hot. And I found out about it later. This cook, he got this tray out of the oven. He had oven gloves on himself, and he handed it to this little kid to take off him with his bare hands, and it burnt this little lad's hand. Now the second cook told me about it after. He was a nice lad, a Geordie. He come along, he gave the cook a clout, bled his nose. Then he come along to tell me before the cook reported him to the captain. So I went down, I had a do with the cook, told him what I thought of him, and he was muttering in Welsh. Anyway, we had to bandage this little lad's hands. So that night when I went down the fridge with the cook, the chief cook, to sort out the meat for the following day, he used to have it taken out of the deep freeze and leave it in the cooler overnight. So while he was in the deep freeze, I nipped out and shut the door, and I left him in for about half an hour. So I backed down and opened it out. He let him out. He was frozen to the bone, to the marrow. He come out and he called me all the names under the sun. I told him, I said, you should think of these. It's nothing to what you done to that little lad, burning his hands. So that was that. And I ordered stores there. And the ship's chandler, he was only a young chap, much about my age. That time, I'm going back, it was 1946, I'd be 26. He'd be somewhere around the same age now. That was very young for a chap to own a ship's chandler's business. So he was an extremely nice lad, and he told me how he come to have the business. He was wanting to get away from Shanghai too. During the war, well, when the war started and the Japanese landed in Shanghai, a lot of the management staff of Shell Mex in Shanghai, the hierarchy of the Shell business, were all taken prisoner and put in prison camps outside Shanghai. Well, this Ping An, he was only a kiddie then, he was only a lad, in his teens, and apparently he used to sneak food into these Shell chaps who were prisoners and kept them going while they were prisoners of war. He risked his life, I suppose, getting food into them, so that when the war ended, these Shell management people fixed him up as a ship's chandler. He was an extremely nice lad, and he took me ashore to his home. He lived with his father and mother and his wife. He was married, and him and his wife lived with the father and mother and some brothers and sisters. So he took me to dinner. I wasn't too keen on it because I don't like Chinese cooking. And they have all the stuff in little bowls in the centre of the table, and you'd sit around with your chopsticks and just all muck in the one bowl. And the following day I went ashore and went walking round Shanghai, and there's all sorts of traders in the streets there. And there was one place I was fascinated by it. They were like joiners, and they made linen chests out of camphor wood, right from small boxes like jewellery boxes to large chests, 3 foot long by 1.5 foot wide by 1.5 foot high. And the plane, they made the chest, and then the little lads, they didn't look more than about 8 or 9 years old, sitting around with hammers and chisels carving the outsides of them, and an old man supervising, watching them. It was fascinating to watch these little kids. I think there were 3 of them to each chest, and the carving is absolutely marvellous. So I bought one of these big ones, and when you bought it, they arranged for a chap to, with a little cart, to take it down and bring them and put them on board the ship for you. So I done that. I really thought they were very good. Well, when came time for us to leave Shanghai, Ping An, the ship's chandler, come aboard to see me. He says, I've brought a present for you. So I said, oh yes, what is it? So he went outside and called this fellow in, and one of his men came in with another of these chests, the same size, different design, but the same size. I had to say thank you. But I wondered, how the hell am I going to get home with these things? So that was it. So Communists were just coming into Shanghai the day we sailed. We left there. It was terrible seeing these people. And I shook hands with Ping An and said, you know, how are you going to go on? He says, well, I have some arrangements made. He says, I'm hoping to get away at the end of this week. Whether he ever did or not, that's another story. I don't know whether he did or not. But we left Shanghai and we went to Hong Kong and stayed overnight there. Then the following day we up anchored and set sail and we went to a place called Miri, M-I-R-I, Miri in Sarawak, that's Borneo, as it used to be called. And we loaded there for Australia. At Miri we had to lie at anchor offshore to load the cargo, and the cargo was pumped from shore by submersed underwater pipelines which were hooked up and connected up to the ship, and the oil was pumped out from the shore installation. So we never got ashore in Miri. Mind you, it was stinking hot there, I wasn't too worried. Once we were loaded, we set off for Australia and we got off the northern coast of Australia, a place called, we had to stop at a place called Thursday Island and take a pilot on board there to run us down the Barrier Reef. Now on the way down from Hong Kong to Thursday Island, one of the firemen in the engine room been doing a job and he got a bit of a steel splinter into his eye. And we had to ask for a doctor to be sent out to see to him at Thursday Island while we lay at anchor there while the doctor came out. Now it's peculiar thinking back on it. On ships with small crews, the ship's doctor was the chief steward. Crazy, isn't it? And apparently it goes back to the days of sailing ships. When they used to have any problems and they'd done amputations and that, the cook, being the most proficient with a knife, used to do the amputations. And that's why, up to when I left the sea, the nickname for the cook was always Doc. Always called the cook Doc. So the chief steward was in charge of the medicine chest, and he had to see to these things. Now it's it was very simple, really. Looking back, we had a book on all the ships. It was called the Ship's Captain's Medical Guide. The Ship's Captain's Medical Guide. It was a red cover book. I can see it now as I'm sitting here. And you opened it up, and in the first part, there was a drawing of a man's body, and it was cut up and divided into sections. If I remember right, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sections. So if a man came to you and he said he was feeling ill, you used to say to him, where about? Show me where you're feeling ill. And he pointed. And you checked it in the book what section it was in. So then you turned the pages over till you come to a chapter referring to that section. And it gave you a list of questions to ask. Are your bowels working? Things like that. And it was all, you deduced it down from these questions in the book. And you say, oh, it must be so-and-so. And then in the book it told you to give so many doses of such and such a medicine. Now in the medicine chest, all these bottles were in a row there and all the medicines were numbered. So in the book it would tell you, give a dose of number 3 mixture morning and night. It was all so simple. But of course there was other medical parts that you had to read up on. So anyway, I had to help the doctor when he came aboard. And he was a real coarse little chap, he was. And he said to me, he says, "Have you got a spud?" So I said, "A what?" He said, "A spud." So I said, what's a spud?" He says, "It's a thing for digging bits out of the eye." This fireman was sitting on the chair shivering. So I said, "No, I haven't seen it." So I took him down to the medicine chest. Now, in the medicine chest, there were all things for operations. Saws, scalpels, everything that needed in an operation. Clamps, tourniquets, everything you could perform an operation with the tools that are there. And glass tubes sealed up, and in them was a needle ready threaded for stitching that was sealed up in surgical spirit. Quite a few of these, everything you could think of. So he looked around and he couldn't find it. He said, "I can't find any spud." So he said to me, "You don't happen to have a sailmaker's needle, do you? That's one of these big needles sailors used to sew canvas with in the days of the sailing ships." So I didn't have any, so he said, "Well, perhaps the bosun will have one." So I run down to the bosun and asked him, and he said, "Oh yeah, I've got a sail," what they call them, they were a sailmaker's needle. So I got this sailmaker's needle and took it up to this chap, and he just bathed it in some surgical spirit, and he poured some, don't know what the liquid was, into this chap's eye. It turned his eye all red, and then he started digging with this needle into this chap's eyeball. Oh, it was turning me sick. Anyway, he got it out. I had to give this lad, the fireman, a good shot of rum. The doctor had a shot, and I had a shot of rum too. So he went ashore, and then we set sail down the Barrier Reef. Now we were halfway down to Sydney,